Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress Diane Kruger. I went by myself to see Diane's new film, In the Fade, late on a rainy Tuesday afternoon. And I had an experience that I think exemplifies exactly why we all go to the movies. I was transfixed by the events that unfolded in directors Fatih Akin's German-language film about a terrorist attack. And I was also transfixed by the actress in virtually every scene of that film. Stepping out into the dark, wet streets afterwards, the world looked and felt differently to me, as if I had been through my own traumatic experience and was still feeling the effects. Diane Kruger gives a powerful, raw, and visceral performance unlike anything I've ever seen. In the Fade gets at the deepest fears a parent can have, and Diane holds the audience in the grip of her grief and anger. Doing my research later, I stumbled across a quote from the late Manola Dargis of the New York Times, who said in her review of the 2000 film Troy that Kruger was, quote, too beautiful to ever play a role of substance. And besides being the epitome of a backhanded compliment, that quote turned out to be laughably untrue and incredibly demeaning for Kruger, a former model who at that point had made just two films, and yet the media and Hollywood were already trying to place her in a box. Thankfully for all of us, that didn't work out so well. Diane has become a cinematic force in three different countries, most notably in projects like Farewell My Queen, Inglourious Basterds, the FX series The Bridge, and the aforementioned In the Fade. We talk about the acting career that may not have happened if her knee had held up, how a chaotic and difficult upbringing gave her her independence, and how preparing for a film can be a lonely and devastating experience. On my walk home after seeing In the Fade, my wife called and asked me how the film was. I told her it was really good, but that she shouldn't go see it. Probably not what Diane wants to hear, but the truth is her performance has the power to induce nightmares, and I don't need that in my house. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
You know, I was a little disappointed, actually, that you didn't show up on a motorcycle.
I know. Actually, me too. I wish it was out here.
Well, it's funny. I read that you got your motorcycle license.
Yeah, I just did.
You did?
Yeah, so I'm still a beginner. But I got this really cool 1972 Honda, which is only like 100cc. It's basically a moped. But, you know, I'm learning. It's really fun. I don't know if I want to drive in the city, but, you know, in the woods and the countryside.
Yeah. What was the impetus for starting riding?
Well, my partner has like six motorcycles, and
okay.
We go on trips all the time, and I really love that. I love
And you're
to
on
go.
The back.
Yeah, I'm on the back, and I love going to, you know, like on 7-hour drives, or I actually did Australia once for 2 weeks on a motorcycle. I just love being outside, you know, and I love the idea of just not being in traffic and just
right.
be free, you know?
Right.
So I don't know, I just thought, why not? Why not try it?
Yeah, and how was the test?
I will say, so I'm not American, and I was kind of shocked. They gave me my license in 4 days, which in Europe, it takes like months to make your license. Like, you have to be on the road, you have to be on the freeway, you have to drive at night during rain. It takes forever to do your motorcycle license.
As it should.
As it should, right? One
yeah.
would think. I went to a Harley dealership in Senoia, Georgia.
Okay.
I'd never turned on a motorcycle myself. 2 days of written, you know, just learning about the written stuff, which is the easy part. And then never left the parking lot, never shifted higher than third gear, and they handed me my license.
Really? So you never actually had to go out and
Ever.
Like stop at a red light or
nope.
change lanes or really?
Nope. So, yeah, so I'm still learning. I'm not ready to go to traffic. If you see me, avoid me.
Yeah, it's a funny thing.
It's definitely not easy, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you have to learn a lot of stuff. That's why I got a really small one, too, because I feel like it's forgiving, you know, and it's an old motorcycle. It's a kickstart, which is a bit of a pain.
Oh, yeah.
But so every third time, it doesn't really start up. But
that's impressive, though, that you're, like, getting on an old vintage bike. And
so pretty. It's like orange. It's
wow.
like, yeah, it's a piece of beauty.
Well, I have to tell you, I saw your film a couple nights ago, In the Fade, and this may sound counterintuitive to having you on the show, but I saw it by myself, and mm-hmm. then I talked to my wife on the phone right after, and she said, how was it? And I said, well, I recommend that you don't see it.
Thanks a lot.
Which the counterintuitive part is, you're so good in this film, and the film is so incredible. It's not one of these films that leaves you after a day or a week.
Yeah.
And knowing my wife and knowing her relationship to our kids and what kind of things that she manifests in her head, this is not a film that you can shake off.
Yeah.
And we should say, you play a woman who loses her husband and her son in a terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. And the film goes further, I think, than almost anything I've ever seen in exploring the grief and the loss and the abyss that that one goes into in a situation like that. And I was so moved by the film, and I have a million questions about it. But I should start with saying that it's the first German film you've ever done.
Yeah, which is weird, right? I mean, I did leave 25 years ago, so I don't really know anyone in the German film industry.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know. I feel like they were, for them, I was gone. You know, even though I'm well-known in Germany, but I kind of abandoned them in their minds, you know, because I started out in France and worked here. But I really have been waiting for a role like this, and I kind of forced destiny. I met the director in Cannes. I was a jury member at the film festival, and he had a documentary in a parallel selection. And he's a very, very well-known director in Germany. And
Fatih Akin,
yeah. And his films sort of, I grew up with his films. Like, he's really, he's like the German version of Inarritu or Spielberg. You know, he's really, really well-known. And so I thought this was my opportunity to meet him. And I went to his party after party, and I said, you know, if you ever want to make a film with me, I would love that. And he remembered 5 years later.
He did.
Yeah.
I wondered if from the start, like when you first got this script, how, like what clues you started looking for in your prep to sort of understand the kind of film it was. Because there's a lot of scenes where you're not saying anything, and a lot of the acting is internal, or it's visceral, and it's not a lot of dialogue. I would think there's a lot of work you had to do.
Yeah, emotional work. I was really worried that I wasn't gonna be able to do it because, as you know, like I don't even have children. How can I possibly know what it must feel like to lose everything, you know? And so I was really kind of scared to not be able to find a truth, you know, in this for me in this role, and how do I get to the ending without giving it away. Seemed to be so extreme, the ending. I wasn't sure how I would make that believable.
Right.
And so as soon as I started researching, I met somebody who allowed me to come in and sit in on self-help groups in New York. And so there are lots of families that have lost children or family members, not just terrorism, but also really brutal murder. And obviously I knew that was going to be a hard thing to do. But as the weeks and the months passed, you know, 6 months, and I would go twice a week, sometimes three times a week.
Okay, I had to stop you there for a minute because I would think a lot of actors would go, okay, I'll go to a couple meetings, I'll pick up what I need. Did something happen like in the fourth or fifth month of going to these meetings that you sort of lose the plot a little bit of like,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
It starts to haunt you. It's hard for me even to describe it to you because I cannot express in words the unspeakable grief and loss of their losses and their lives and what these people face and how they live. It's very hard for me to describe, and it started to haunt me. I couldn't shake it. It was like a drug. I felt like I had to go more and more. And in the beginning, I'd sit there, and obviously they knew why I was there, and they allowed me to ask questions.
Did you feel uncomfortable?
Yeah, I felt like an asshole. You know, here's this privileged actress who, so how did it feel to lose your kid, you know?
Who's going to take down your life and try to...
Yeah, analyze it and try to, you know, pick up your tears for a movie role, you know? So really quickly, I stopped asking questions, and I would just sit there, you know, and I'd just listen, really observed. And what started to happen was it's sometimes more an energy, you know. It felt like I was absorbing their pain, you know, and I just listened to their stories. I just allowed myself to feel what they must be going through, you know, and the different stages of grief and the different ways people process grief. But I couldn't shake it, you know. I dream of it every night, and I started to get this acute sense of responsibility that I hadn't quite, I guess, realized was going to happen, you know, that I'm actually somehow, in the strange world we live in as an actor, I'm somehow the voice of these people. You know, this is a film about people that stay behind. And there's been plenty of films about terrorist attacks or bombs or whatever, but you don't really get to see what it's like for the people that have to live with that. And can you even live with that? How do you go on living, you know?
Right, that's true. I feel like the unique part about this film is it focuses so little on the attack itself or the events leading up to the attack.
Yeah.
It's almost like the audience just needs to get that information that that happens so we can start the story.
And I started to feel a little bit ashamed of myself too, because I'm just like everybody, you know, you watch TV and unfortunately we live in a world with where these attacks are more and more common, not just from neo-Nazis, it could be jihadists or, you know, some crazy guys running amok. And so I realized, like, we've become so focused on numbers, right? A kind of people
who did
died.
It, how many people were killed, how did he get
what
the
was
weapons?
His motives, and, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but we don't talk about the Katyas, which is my character's name, right, that are being created every time this happens. And we don't check in 6 months later or a year later, you know?
Right. What I found interesting about the film is that your character makes some really bad decisions, but every single one of them was completely authentic and believable because of what she was going through.
Yeah, and I like that. You know, I think it's important that just because she's the victim of this, she's not, you know, a perfect human being, you know.
So that's to your point of we don't get to see these people, what they go through afterwards.
Right.
Or we get this version of them that they become almost martyred at the same time that this happens.
Exactly.
And they're not real.
That's not real, you know.
Right. So let's get back to the idea of, you know, when you get a script like this and you read it and you make this decision to go to these groups, mm-hmm. these grief therapy sessions, it's almost like for an actor, there's no rule book on how to do what you need to do.
Yeah, so I took the time, which is the real luxury here, is to take the time to prepare. I think I stopped working maybe 4 months before this film started. You know, I started prepping 6 months before, and then 4 months before the filming, I only did that, and then moved to Germany 2 months early so that I could live in Germany again. You know, I lived in the same area as my character would have lived, you know, find the look, you know, cut my hair, become this person in her social setting, how she must have grown up. You know, and I am German, so I know Katyas. I've grown up with people like her. You know, there's a huge stigma in Germany about blonde, blue-eyed German girls marrying Turkish men, you know.
Right. Okay, yeah, we should say that your husband in the film is a Turkish.
Is Turkish, yeah. And so the movie's...
And a convicted and reformed drug dealer.
Yeah, and the movie's based on true events where between, I think, 2002 and 2007, neo-Nazis killed 9 people. And they were of Turkish descent, and they didn't find the actual shooters and bombers. And so they, because they were Turkish and some of them had a record, they immediately were taken for as being in on it, being
right.
like being the Turkish mafia or, you know, some drug-related murders. And my director was also Turkish, German, born in Germany, but of Turkish parents. It's something that he's always really rejected. Him growing up, he had to face racism and prejudices all of his life, and it makes him really angry, you know,
right.
understandably so.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about this idea of when you don't have a playbook on how to create a character, mm-hmm. you have all this time, 5 or 6 months. I mean, if you're an actor that's done a body of work, you've all been involved in films where they come out and they disappear 2 weekends later,
yeah.
and it's like, what am I doing all this work for? Like, what you're describing seems to me like, in some ways, the most beautiful thing an artist can do, which is dive deep into something.
Yeah.
But also, there must be some questioning of all of that.
I think sometimes it depends on the director you're working with as well. Like, I knew that Fatih was skilled enough and revered enough director that this movie wasn't just going to go away in 2 weeks, at least in Europe, you know, in Germany. So right. I had faith that he was going to elevate not just me, but the movie, you know, with his camera work. And he, his films are always meaningful, and they stay. They really marked my generation, like they really did in Germany. So I was just ready, you know. I think when I read it, I knew that this part was going to change my life one way or the other. And it really did. Like even without all the awards and all the attention we've been getting, just on a human level, and I don't just say that as a, you know, some actress's cliche response, I discovered in myself an empathy and an ability to feel for another person that I didn't think I had in me. And I've come out of this experience feeling incredibly lucky that I'm alive and that I'm here and that I hopefully never have to go through what these people I've met go through. And I really, really mean that.
What do you attribute that to more? Was it your own journey of finding the character, or was it the relationship you developed with Fatih through the process?
It's a little bit a combination of both. You know, my relationship with Fatih over the months that we worked together became very much, you know, we found each other. Like, it's really rare when you have an actor and a director who really gel, you know.
And we should put in perspective, I mean, you said he was like Inarritu or Spielberg to you in Germany. Like, that's a big deal when you get this, that you, I mean, was the centralized fear of, I don't want to let him down, or I want to prove, I mean, was there something you had to prove also because of the weird relationship you have with German audiences and the fact that
you're... there was a lot of that. And also, he got a lot of heat for casting me. Like, he's sort of famous there for hiring local actors or non-actors, which has always made his films really authentic, you know? So when news first broke that he cast me, there was a lot of heat on him. People were like,
really?
Why are you casting Diane Kruger? You know, she's a Hollywood actress. Like, what's happening? You know.
So the German community sees you as a Hollywood actress who left Germany to go get the money or to go be glamorous.
And I owe him a lot because I know that when even though he made that decision, he wasn't 100% convinced that, you know, this was going to work out.
Did you have to convince him, or do you think that?
I mean, I just felt like I needed to keep my head down and be humble, and I just decided I was going to say yes to everything he asked me to do, and never questioned his methods you know, jumped off the cliff with him. And I think as the weeks passed in prep, he realized that I was doing that, and he started to trust me. And I feel like maybe a week before we started filming, I knew we were this was going to be good, you know?
It's interesting. I always wonder if, I mean, obviously your job as an actor is to be open and to open yourself up so that an audience can get that transference of emotion. But if you don't have that connection with the director. Mm. Is it possible to have a fearless performance if you don't have that level of trust? Like, did you have to build that with him?
It's never pleasant to be really naked, you know, emotionally in front of anyone, I think, because as us as humans, you know, that's very intimate and you don't want to share that with everyone, you know. And yet it is our job. But if you feel like a director doesn't really trust you, or he doesn't, you know, cherish that somehow. We all have fragile egos, I think. And if you don't feel like a director is going to protect you and, you know, through his lens, love you for what you give him, you know, it's not so easy. So I'm sure better skilled actors they do it anyway and they don't care. But for me, I know that I'm better when I feel like a director really is, you know, has my back.
What you're saying is that even though you're a character, it's still impossible not to also have your own ego or your own confidence, your own fear wrapped up in it.
Oh yeah, it's all you, even though you're playing somebody else. But, you know, to cry, to be emotional, to laugh, to love, it's all drawn from your own experiences. So it's actually weird, the older you get, the more you have to bring to the table, obviously.
What do you mean?
Well, you have more life experiences, right? Like, you've experienced grief or heartbreak or real love or lust. So, you can have a more nuanced performance. So it gets, in my head anyway, sometimes more complicated because I feel like I'm so obviously naked and everybody can see or must see what I've been going through or not, you know? So it makes you very vulnerable. When I was younger, I felt like it was much easier to act, right? The older you get, it feels like you're not really acting that much anymore, you know?
Right. When you're younger, you think that no one can see you, or you think that you're tricking
so cool.
Everybody.
You're tricking. You're cooler than everybody, you know?
Right.
But the fear thing, that doesn't go away, because a character like this also brings you back to your own fear in your own life. Like, holy shit, what if that happens to me? Or, like, what if I lose somebody? What would I do? I'm like the audience in that way. You read a script and you go, wow, what would I do? And so it's all mixed. It's all real life that mixes in with trying, really desperately trying to find the truth for that particular character, you know?
So in other words, throughout the process, there were probably times when it was extremely uncomfortable or lonely.
Oh, yeah.
Or scary. And then somewhere in the back of your mind, you have a little voice that says, oh, but this is really good. I can use this. But
yeah, it's a mix of it all. You know, I try to be in control as much as one can be in situations or scenes that are very naked, open, and vulnerable. And, you know, I think I'm skilled enough now to be able to do it a couple times. You know, that's the other thing. Like, when you're younger, you can get there, but once maybe, and then, I don't know, maybe you can't do it again, you know?
So when you're younger, maybe you have this one day where it's amazing, but then the next day you don't have it.
I think with maturity and with experience, in your head you try to build this character. And what helped me here, we shot in order. So that was...
Oh, in chronological order.
Yes, in chronological order. So that was a huge help, as you can imagine. I knew the first 3 weeks were going to suck because they were just, you know, the loss and the accident.
Did you have something you didn't want this performance to be that you were afraid if you weren't careful it could have fallen into that?
I mean, you don't want it to be overly dramatic, you know. Nobody wants to see some hysterical woman who is just relentless in her pain and crying, you know, and I think pain and grief, you have to find a nuance without being untruthful of what grief is. So I was worried about, but at the same time, I knew with Fatih that he wouldn't allow that to happen. So that's where the trust comes in again, you know.
Right.
If I was too much in a scene, he would rein me in, you know, or if he felt like I wasn't enough in one direction, he pushes you, right? That's where the collaboration comes in.
Right, so you didn't have to modulate your own performance because you trusted him.
I trusted him blindly, you know, that's what makes a good film, I think, is when you don't make it alone. Like, I'm nothing without my director, and I think he's nothing without his actors, you know, and the crew, and you know, sometimes a scene hinges on whether the light is ready fast enough, for example. You know, other scenes are more technical, and what I've learned with experience is not to be afraid to ask for time if you need time. You know, I think when you're younger, you're so worried that, I don't know, you're going to get fired or people think you can't do it, you know. And I think with age, I've learned to say, you know, I'm not there. I need more time, or help me. I don't know how to do this.
Do you think this was a character you couldn't put a box at the end of the day shooting and put her on the next morning? Did you sort of have to accept the uncomfortable nature of the film? Was it a more method situation, or did you get deeper into this person and have to stay there?
I'm not a method kind of actor. You know, I went to theater school, as drama school, like not method acting, so... This, I didn't mean it to be method, and I definitely, you know, went home at night and tried to not think about it, but it kind of felt like I couldn't do that, you know, it just, unconsciously, I couldn't get out of it, and it felt at times like I was drowning, you know, a little bit, because when you live and feel such extreme emotions, every day and I'm in every frame of this movie.
Yeah.
You just don't go home and, like, you know, have a massage. And it just doesn't, I didn't feel like it. I just wanted to be by myself and go to bed, you know.
Right. No, I mean, your performance is incredible. The film was so absorbing that I almost felt like a part of your family. Like when your character goes in and does, like, some crystal meth at some point or some crap.
Opium, yeah, and some, yeah.
Some opium, okay. So I'm not...
And cocaine.
Not up on all my drug paraphernalia. That was opium. But, you know, in my heart in the film, I was like, oh, don't do that. Like,
don't do that. Yeah.
Like, you know, there was a very realistic portrayal of a downward spiral that comes with grief that isn't like anything we've seen on camera. And you know, I couldn't help wondering what going through this process brought up for you personally.
It made me so acutely aware. What I took away most from all the terrible stories that I heard is the sense that all of them had this rage that in 1 second their life changed out of their control, and nothing will ever be the same as it was, no matter how many years pass or how many more children you have. And I know we all know that deep down, like we should live in the moment and we should, you know, but I really saw that, and I really witnessed that, and their shock of that will never be the same. And had I, you know, the guilt, had I not dropped my kid off too late, or had I been on time to pick my kid up, or, you know, and I don't know. I know we all know that. That's what I take away from this movie is try to live harder and love harder, you know, because it can all be over literally in like now, you know.
Hence the motorcycle.
Yeah, actually, you know what? You're right, because I felt like I don't want to look back and think I didn't do it, you know. Had I done it, why didn't I do it? You know, I think I've made changes in my life, in my personal life, that have started to reflect that. I think I'm a little bit kinder maybe to other people than I was before. I feel humbled, you know. I don't think I was a horrible person, but I think maybe, you know, maybe I didn't say I love you to my mom when I hung up the phone the other day, or, you know what I mean, or I yelled at the cab driver because he was taking the wrong street. You know, that's
because you assume life is forever.
Yeah, and you know.
We all do that, of course.
Of course we all do that.
I would imagine that this kind of experience, when you think about it, is exactly why being an actor can be so fulfilling. In the sense that you get the opportunity for your job to dive deep into something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't always happen, you know. You know, I'm like the first person, like sometimes I read interviews by actors in magazines, and I'm like, oh, I roll my eyes and I think, oh God, you know, they live in some sort of bubble, you know. And the truth is, I do, you know, I do. I live in a world where we sit in fancy clothes and somebody asks me all these questions.
These clothes aren't that fancy.
Well, mine are kind of fancy, you know, and we do, but it's every once in a while you get a role, and maybe this was the first one for me, where I realized all that quite, and I'm thankful that I got this opportunity, you know, and a role like this doesn't come along every day. But then also, I have to say, it has to do with being mature enough to take on a role like this too. You know, I'm not sure I could have played this 5 years ago. So life is kind sometimes, you know, it came to me, I think, at the right time in my life and my career, where I was able to recognize that, and we'll see moving forward. But every part I've taken, I've gone into with the same enthusiasm, you know, and even the movies that nobody's seen, you know, you go, I gave it 100%, you know.
Right. So, well, what's fascinating to me is that you almost have, I mean, you are a movie star in France in the sense of Big lead roles. The French have sort of accepted you as their own. You've juried a Cannes and festival. And then you have this completely other perception in Germany that's changing as we're speaking, right? And then in the United States, you're almost like another different actor. Yeah. In other words, I feel like you've created this life where you're perceived different ways in different countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a little bit out of your control, you know.
Right.
I mean, I think that my best or more rewarding roles have been definitely in France. I think in America so far, mostly except for maybe Inglourious Basterds, have been cast as, you know, the girl next to ex-movie star, you know, in big blockbuster films. It's been super lovely to be here and talk about this movie, and having been so welcomed with a role like this, and maybe people see you differently, right. You know. So we'll see, you know, we'll see if I'm allowed to do that in America as well.
What differences have you noticed between Europe and the U.S.? Not just the roles you get, but the way women are treated and the way they're maybe allowed to have more complex roles or to age more gracefully?
I think the big difference is that, generally speaking, French cinema is auteur-driven. It's director-driven, not so much about movie stars-driven, you know. So I think the films are smaller, but there's roles for women of all ages. You know, you don't cast a 30-year-old opposite a 55-year-old man,
right?
And it's not so. You know, I find here most often they cast the male lead, right, and then he often gets to have a say of who his much younger partner is. And it is what it is. I hope things are changing. I think they are a little bit, you know. And then a lot of the box office is king here, and producers are more powerful, I think, than they are in France. And they get to pick and say and control the cut of the film even. You know, in France, for example, that doesn't exist. The director always has final cut. Always.
As it should be.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, you'd go, you know, the film could really lose 10 or 15 minutes.
Right.
But it's his baby, right? So, yeah, I agree with you. You know?
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, I was doing some research and watching old interviews, and I came across an interview that you did. And I'm not going to say what show it was or who the host was, mm-hmm. but I think it was around Troy.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus became completely about what you were wearing and that your stomach was showing.
Oh, yeah.
And even to the point of he asked you to turn and sit a different way so the audience can see you. And then he said, oh, he wasn't listening because he was, you know. Uh-huh. And I don't know. I just watched this and I thought, God, you know, it must have been because you feel like you get your shot, right? You get this big opportunity next to some big actors with a big director and a big budget.
Yeah.
And you're in this film, and then it seems like such a reductive thing.
Oh, yeah. I remember when that film came out, too. The New York Times, of all newspapers, it said, and Diane Kruger is too beautiful to ever play a role of substance.
So
coming from the New York Times, that's really, really sad. You know what I mean?
Right. And I would assume when you got this role in Troy, that it seemed like a major opportunity, right?
Of course. You know, looking back, I was completely green. It was my second movie.
Right.
And, you know, it definitely was an amazing opportunity. At the same time, held me back for many years. You know, where do you go from playing Helen of Troy?
And where do you go from a perception being put out there? You have to go through all of that with a smile on your face, and it's completely out of control. How much harder is that journey for a woman?
You know, I don't know if I want to say it's hard. It's not hard being a woman, but it just feels like you have to just try so much harder and put up with, you know, and just smile through so many things to try and get to what you want, you know? I cannot tell you how many times, and as you get older, thankfully, you start caring less, but I just remember being on sets, and still to this day, you know, if you have an issue with a script, or you have a problem, or you feel strongly about a creative choice, or you just, you know, want to speak up about your character, you get labeled as being difficult, or being a bitch, or, you know, being harsh, whether a man would just be called a great actor, and he's so invested in his role, and he's a great businessman, you know?
Right.
And you have to dance around so many things.
Or just, he's assertive.
Yeah, you know, and that sucks. It's so tiresome, you know? And as you get older, thankfully, you go, I don't give a if they think I'm a bitch, you know, I'm just going to say it. But I'm not. I'm really not. I just, it is frustrating, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that, to me, and I think, I don't know why watching that one interview did it for me so much, but it must feel completely unfair. It's almost sad to hear that you get older and you don't care anymore, because that's almost saying like, well, that's just the way the world is.
But it is sometimes. You know, I think things are changing, and I think as I grow older, I'm more assertive, you know, and I create that space for myself where I don't allow that kind of behavior, you know. But that comes with maturity. I think when you're a young girl, and you don't know any better. And by the way, I was a model, right? I mean, I was, and I think it's going to take a generation, because it's going to take you as a man teaching your daughters that that is not acceptable. And I remember growing up, I grew up without a dad, and the power for me leaving home and being able to go out into the world was through the way I looked, you know. And when you're 16 or 17 and people tell you, oh, you're so pretty, you know, here's money for that, and that's how I lived, you know, you think, oh, you're in control. This is how I'm going to use my power, and this is how I'm going to get ahead. It's only when you get older that you realize that's not how you get ahead, you know. That should not be your way into the world, you know.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit about your upbringing, because I read some things that I really related with in terms of finding yourself away from home. And what I read about your upbringing was that you were a very serious dancer from a young age.
Yeah.
And would you go and live away from home and live at the dance school when you were young?
Yeah, in my vacations, I'd go to London. I studied with the Royal Academy of London. So,
how old were you when you went away and would stay there?
I started going maybe by the time I was 8 or 9. You know, do like for 5 or 6 weeks at
a
time. Yeah.
So that's a pretty long time to be that young.
Yeah, but I, you know, my mom was kind of, you should do that. And it was hard in the beginning because I was homesick, and then I really looked forward to it, you know. And now as a grown woman, I look back and I think that was the best thing she could have done, because she installed a sense of freedom in me, a sense of I could do what I wanted to do. You know, she let me leave home at 16 to move to Paris.
Right.
You know, get out of school. Like, I'm kind of amazed. I'm not sure I would let my 16-year-old daughter be like, yep.
That
Why
sounds
don't
you terrifying
go to Paris?
To me as a parent with my daughters, yes.
But I also really liked it. You know, it started out my mom not having a nanny, and you know, my dad wasn't around. My dad was an alcoholic, so he was not really around. So she had to find a way. She had to work, and so she had to find a way to, when I got out of school, to get, you know, put me into something that she didn't have to worry about me. So that's how it started, and I just really loved it. I loved the, you know, my childhood, I felt, was very tumultuous, and there was a lot of stuff happening at home.
Was your dad around, even though he was?
He was around, but he was, you know, not an upstanding citizen of the world, you know.
Right.
So I don't have great memories of him. So home was always a little bit chaotic. And dancing felt like I could express my emotions and be rewarded for it. And that felt really good. And I didn't realize that, obviously, at the time. But now looking back, I remember, you know, if I was sad or I was angry, I could put that into dancing, you know, and my teacher would applaud me for it. She could feel that was something there, you know.
So you found early on that you needed an outlet for...
I mean, it wasn't conscious to say I needed it. It was just there was no other choice. This is what I was doing, you know. But I think it's made me who I am today, dancing. I owe dancing a lot, yeah.
Was there an age where you thought this was your career path? You were going to end up on stage at the Royal Ballet?
Yeah, for a minute, yeah. And then puberty happened, and my body changed, and it was just getting harder and harder for me, you know.
So at the age when most kids are still, you know, bumbling around, not knowing what they're doing, you sort of had a career crisis.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, were you that kind of kid? Were you that focused?
Yeah, also it felt like now what do I do? I'm back home, you know, I don't go to London anymore. What am I going to do? I definitely did not enjoy school. I wasn't a bad student per se, but I didn't like school. I really didn't. And I was in a school that was sort of specialized into physics and math, and I
like
hated
the total
that,
wrong
you know?
School. For
yeah,
you.
Totally.
Yeah. But you did love performing.
Yeah, I did. But it took me. But you know, like for example, so I live in a village of 2,000 people, right, where I grew up.
Okay.
And acting, for example, that was not something that was even an that nobody said, oh, why don't you try acting? I thought you had to live in the big city. You had to be discovered. I didn't know there were drama schools. Or, you know, my mother or my family, nobody in my family has ever done anything artistic. My mom wanted me to be an accountant because she worked in a bank. And, you know, that I did not see that for myself. So I was kind of lost for a long time. And
how did that make the relationship between you and your mom?
I mean, she was... I love my mom. You know, she was she wanted what's best for me. She just wanted me to have a stable job, and you know, she herself went through a lot. You know, I had a younger brother who was very mixed up because of the situation at home. You know, so there was just it was chaotic at home. You know, and she tried her best. And when modeling came along, I think she was kind of happy that someone had taken an interest in me, and obviously I cherished the opportunity to go to Paris and do all these things. And she was worried for me, I'm sure. Also, you know, I didn't grow up in a home where being pretty, my mom never told me, oh, you're so pretty. Never, you know. So she
You never
kind
heard
of,
that?
Never. My mom was kind of surprised. Also, I'm not really tall. Like, I don't really, you know, look like a model. She was like, really? Like, they want you to model, you know? Like, my mom is the kind of person... I remember she came to a movie set once, and she'd never been to a movie set, and it was a period film in France, and we were playing at the Sorbonne, and there were tons of like 100 extras in costume, and I thought she would love that, you know, to be part of it, and I was so proud she came, and I put her next to the director, and you know how it is on a movie set, you shoot it 1,000 different ways, and there's lots of people, so it took a long time, and she finally came over to me and said, what are you doing wrong? Why do you have to keep doing it over? Why can't you get it right? You know, that's my mom.
Right, right. So clearly, you have a healthy sense of humility.
Yeah.
She didn't. You know. She didn't make you feel like
no.
You walked on clouds.
No.
Does it still sometimes strike you as improbable that this is your life?
Yes.
It does.
And to her too. Like she's come with me a lot. You know, on this press tour for In the Fade, she was with me in Cannes, and you know, we won like the German Oscar and stuff, and. Yeah, I mean, we look at each sometimes and we're like, I can't believe this is it, you know?
God. Well, take me back to getting the opportunity to model. Did you have a plan at that point?
No.
No, like you were like, well, I can start here and I can act or nothing.
No.
It was literally a chance to get out of your house and go to Paris.
Yeah, and make money. You know, I did not grow up with money. I mean, we weren't like dirt poor or anything, but like those... I had to make a living.
Right.
You know, my mom couldn't help me out at all. So
So how do you discover acting? And how long did it take in modeling to find out that that didn't fit?
It was kind of fun in the beginning, although people would always tell me that I was too short, you know, and
again, building you up with...
Well, modeling is not really a job that builds you up.
No.
You know what I mean? I worked very well, and I did a lot of really, you know, high-profile jobs, but it also got really boring after a while, I'm not going to lie. And I met a guy in France who was an actor, and he said, you know, why don't you go to drama school? I was like, really? You can go to drama school? He's like, yeah.
So you really didn't know?
No, I really didn't know. And so I wrote myself into this classic theater school in France called Cours Florent. And that was kind of the best time in my life, in a way, when I look back. Because I didn't go to college, obviously. And it was just me and kids my age and, you know, studying Victor Hugo and Molière and smoking way too many cigarettes and thinking we were going to change the world and we were so cool, you know, talking about scenes every day.
Yeah.
I loved it.
It's funny to think about that period of, because, you know, for me, I came up as a photographer, mm-hmm. and I think the part I enjoyed most was the very beginning when
yeah.
the only stakes were earning a paycheck.
Right.
And, you know, and
nothing
and so,
to lose, right?
Yes, yeah. And every victory felt like it felt really good.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you talk a little bit about how you sort of got to know yourself or understood a little more what you wanted to do through some of those little victories?
It just felt like a huge relief. I remember to get into this school, which is, you know, a very well and renowned school, you had to do an improv. And I'd never been up on stage and performed, like, you know, with my words. I'd obviously been on stage dancing, but I was really worried about it. Also, it's in French, right? And even though I speak fluent French, I'm definitely the odd one out, right?
When did you start speaking French?
Just moving to Paris. I studied Latin in school.
And so you didn't speak French at all until you moved there?
That's right. And I still, like, I speak it fluently now. You probably wouldn't hear an accent, but I don't really write it. You know,
I definitely wouldn't hear an accent.
Well, I don't know.
I'm amazed, by the way, at what you can do language-wise.
No, oh,
that
thanks.
You're German, that you barely have an accent.
Oh.
You did a film last year, Sky, but in it you play a woman who has a thicker French accent than, like, you're a German person playing a French woman who's speaking English with a thicker French accent. I mean, it's astounding what you're able to do with that. That, right in itself, is amazing. But to hear that you didn't even speak French until you got there.
Yeah.
So how long before you decided to audition for the school?
I was there for, I want to say, 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
I mean, I traveled so much. I had a place in New York. You know, I was definitely busy as a model.
Right.
And I really liked it in the beginning. I feel like I moved back to Paris because I got my heart broken for the first time by some American dude. And I was like, that, you know, I was like, I'm going back to Paris. I'm going to make this decision. I'm going to go to drama school and, you know, screw everybody. Because I was so worried. Like, once I started, like, thinking about it and I would run it by friends, everybody was like, oh, of course, the model that wants to act. You know, that was, like, the big thing back then.
Right.
And it took me a while until I felt like, you all, I'm just going to...
By the way, you can say whatever you want on this show.
Okay, good. So fuck you all. I'm going to just do what I have to do, and you can all suck a dick. So so that's what I did.
That's interesting, though, because I think that when an artist gets to the point where they say, what I want to do is more important than what people think of me, that is, I think, step one in...
Yeah, and like I said, that's when my life changed, because once I stopped caring so much about perception and what people, you know, the closets and the pigeonholes that people want to put you in, once I freed myself of that, my life became a lot better. You know, it took me a long time, but I'm sure you feel the same way, but I don't care. I don't care. You know, you think I can't do this? If I get the opportunity, I'm just going to do it, you know?
I have to say that getting to that point, especially with, and I don't know if this is specific to your upbringing, but the cliched idea of an absent father, and it's that much more of a hill to climb to build up a self-confidence to be able to say that.
I have to tell you, now that I'm older, I really miss not having had a dad. A male figure in my life. I had my grandfather, but he obviously is my grandfather, so it's not the same thing. But I think I would have done a lot better in my life younger if I had had a good male influencer in my life. And it's funny, I really hope that I get to have a family, if I ever have kids, where I have a father that's really present for my kid. I think it's invaluable for a girl to have a dad.
When you say that, what are you referencing in your mind of the things that you were missing or that were difficult?
Especially my relationship to men, you know, the way what things that I accepted, like stuff like what you said, for example, you know, maybe if I'd had a male figure, I would have shut that guy down at the get-go. I mean, like, why are we talking about my dress? Let's talk about Troy.
Yeah.
So I just think that I really searched for a long time how to navigate life and men and myself. I see girlfriends that have had great dads, and I'm envious of their relationship, and I feel like they did better earlier, you know, when it comes to that.
Yeah, I always question that whatever struggles or deficiencies we have as children, if we ever really leave it behind.
And we all do. Even if you're a great dad or a great mother, we're always going to, you know, go, oh, my mom, you know, she screwed me up for life.
Yes.
And we try our best. I don't mean that, you know, we're all human. But I do think that, especially for girls, I can obviously only talk for girls, I think we need men to have our backs and push us to become women, good women.
And we as men need women to help us communicate, to help us understand how to treat people. And
I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's funny, I was really thinking about that in the past couple of days, because the Time's Up movement and all that, you know, and it's all girl power. And I obviously 100% support that, but I'm really acutely aware that we need men to walk by our sides. You know, we can't do this alone. It's not just women against the world. You know, we need stand-up men to walk by us, with us.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Because
pressure is on.
That's right. Well, I interrupted you. You were about to tell, I think, a story about your first improv.
So yeah, so I was saying it felt like a relief because I remember going up there and I was kind of nervous leading up to it. You know, I really wanted this to happen. And then I was on stage and it just like it poured out of me. And I remember coming off stage and feeling like, this is it. I found what I want to do in my life.
It hit you like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, no, it really did. And I, you know, obviously knew it was going to be difficult. I wasn't sure if it was going to work out. But I felt like this is the first time in my life, in my young life, that I felt like I can do this. I felt like an emotional connection to what I was doing. I felt engaged. I felt curious. I felt like I was part of something.
Was it that overwhelming that you just immediately knew that this was what you were going to do?
Yeah, it was great. Like, I feel like I had nothing to lose. I feel like it was going to work out.
Gosh, I envy that. I envy finding something and not having to question it. The confidence of whether or not this works out or whether or not I make money or, like, none of that matters. I'm just going to do it.
Well, here's the thing. So because of modeling, I had made a lot of money, so I didn't have to work for a while, right? I felt pretty confident that I could live off of this. And that's a huge luxury when you're that age, you know? I was like 25, and I felt like, I'm going to be cool for a couple of years. I can just dedicate my time and my life to this for a minute.
I should have definitely been a model.
You know, you should have.
I really, when they called, I just was like...
You were like, I'm busy.
Yeah, it's not my thing.
It's not your thing.
No.
Oh, well, there you go.
The world suffered a great loss.
Exactly.
No, but yeah, that's crazy. So you find this thing and I don't know. It's beautiful to find something and to be young enough to know you want to go after it and have the means to go after it.
Huge privilege, right?
Yeah. And then you come to the United States and I'm sure it's was Troy your big break sort of? Mm. That happened pretty young.
It was my second movie.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And it was, as I said before, it was a huge opportunity and a huge get, but I'd never been to Hollywood. I didn't have an agent here. You know, they cast through Europe. But it was also, you know, a huge, way too early for me to get that kind of attention. And I really, looking back, I really felt that. Even that when it happened, I felt that.
You know, it's interesting. At the beginning of this conversation, you said that In the Fade came at the right time.
Yeah.
So you're saying, like, Troy came at the wrong time, really.
Well, the attention was very uncomfortable, you know, and I had no experience of criticism, of being judged or, being part of such a big machine. It was overwhelming, and it was kind of scary a little bit. I remember we premiered Troy in Cannes. I'd never been there. And nobody, you know, nobody knew who I was. And I remember getting out of the car for the red carpet, and all those photographers were yelling my name, you know, because everybody wanted to know who's Helen of Troy, you know.
Right.
And it was so, and then it so felt really overwhelming, and I was kind of scared. And then the criticism of, like, why did they cast her? A blonde girl with a white, you know, with blue eyes? Like, she should look like this. Again, I was judged just on my appearance.
Right.
You know? It felt it was undeserved, you know, that attention. I was so green as an actor.
But also, the thing I would think is so soul-crushing is that it's totally outside of your control.
Yeah.
So what do you walk away, like, how do you deal with that when...
It was a difficult time in my life. Also, like, you know, the press in Germany, I was already living in France, obviously, at the time, but... The press in Germany, because I was German, gave me a lot of attention, and they found my dad, who I hadn't seen since I was 13 years old, and he sold, like, baby pictures.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Stuff like that, and then so that affected my family. It was just so, all the stuff that I had no clue how to deal with. You know, nobody told me that this was going to happen.
Right.
So that it was a weird time in my life. In hindsight, I guess it just toughened me up. I realized that this wasn't going to be, you know, a sweet little ride, and that people are not always going to be just nice and kind, and that I had never experienced people underestimating you, you know, I guess. So that was a big learning curve, you know?
Right. And it's amazing where you've come, and this film is in the fade is it makes me upset that the Oscars make some delineation between foreign films and other films. You know what I mean? There should just be, especially at this point in our history, where films are being made by every nationality of director in every different location.
Yeah. But you know what I got to tell you? I'm really grateful, truly, for all the attention we've been getting since Cannes, because as you said, films that are in foreign language so often go unnoticed here, you know, and they don't find an audience. They get released in four theaters. So
you have to read while you watch
them. Yeah, and you know, people, and it's not an easy film to watch, as you know. So all this just has been so wonderful, and I'm really grateful that it's found its audience here, and you know, that's really what this is all about, because I think it's a film that deserves to be seen for what it talks about, and it's a movie that's very timely, and I think it connects people. You know, it's a very emotional film. It's really a family movie, you know, when you think about it.
Yes, except I won't be taking my kids.
Not your kids, but you know, I think.
No, but it is.
You know what I mean?
Like absolutely, and it's an incredible film.
Yeah,
and. Gosh, getting to know you a little bit.
Thank you.
Through seeing it has been really amazing for
me. Thank you for taking the time.
Of course. I loved hearing about it. And I will tell everyone to watch it except for my wife.
Good. All right.
Just because I don't want to be the person in the middle of the night that she's waking up and saying, we have to talk about
it. We have to talk about stuff. You're like, oh, God.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and I urge you to go check out In the Fade and all of Diane's other work. I also want to encourage you to check out Off Camera as a television show. I know you're listening to the podcast right now, and that's a great way to hear Off Camera. But for those of you who haven't tried out the television experience, it really brings a lot of dimension to the conversation. And right now, you can go to offcamera.com and you can sign up for our monthly subscription, which gives you full access to over 130 hours of off-camera content available to watch at any time, as many times as you want, on any device you wish. It's a great way to experience the show, and it'll always be waiting for you. And also, check us out on social media. We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. You can also send me an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. Tell me how you like the show. Tell me who you'd like to see on the show. And tell me how you experienced the show. And lastly, we couldn't do this show without the help of a lot of great people. We have Nathan Shields handling editing and sound, Crawford Shippey, our producer, Michaela Galvin on graphic design and camera work, Kara Johnson doing our transcriptions, Amy Jones providing valuable wordsmithery, and the great Matt Davidson, who will get his hands dirty for any cause that helps the show. And a big thank you to you, the listener, for tuning into this show, subscribing to it, and being a part of the conversation. You know, we really rely on word of mouth. So if you love the show and you know someone who might like the show, please, for our sake and for theirs, tell them about Off Camera. And then they'll tell two friends, and they'll tell two friends, and so on. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actress and author Jenna Fischer.
I think it was very frightening when my parents visited me in LA. My window to my bedroom faced the back of the pleasure chest. Across the street from that was like a gay porn theater. I can't imagine what that was like. And my mom was like, oh, look, a little movie there. Do you ever go see films there?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, Mom, I don't.
You, of course, know Jenna as the lovable Pam Beasley from The Office, but you may not know that she slogged through the acting trenches in Los Angeles for 8 years, doing industrial films, extra work, and a series of odd jobs, never skipping a step on the ladder of acting success. Well, Jenna wrote a fascinating book about her struggle and perseverance called The Actor's Life, and after reading it, I would argue it is an essential purchase for anyone chasing a dream, whether it be in acting or any other creative field. Join me as I talk to Jenna about dreams, delusion, dildos, and how getting fired can lead to a lot of name dropping. See you next time off camera.